Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 17. I'm going to do the first 30 verses of this long chapter. And this is going to be the old Sunday school story of David and Goliath. We're going to look at it a little bit deeper than you did in Sunday school, I dare say. Our context is this. In the last chapter, David was anointed by Samuel as king. So we start now. This was down at Jesse's house in Bethlehem. We start now in 1 Samuel 17, verses 1 through 3. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Succoth, Azekah, and in Ephes-Damin. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. Now, in verse 1, it says now. That just means we're moving on with the story. We don't worry about the time too much, especially since the scholars are completely at odds with each other as to when the early events in David's life took place. Here's some speculations. Clark said this is 8 years after David's anointing. That would make David roughly in his early 20s. Clark says it's 10 or 12 years after the war with the Amalekites, where Saul beat the Amalekites. 27 years after the Philistines were defeated at Michmash. Those are speculations. We don't know. All we know is it's somewhere at the end of the 11th century B.C. Now, the Philistines, of course, had gotten whopped at Michmash very badly. They'd also been beaten earlier than that before at Mizpah, but they're still around. And now they're gathered for battle again. Some people speculate that the Philistines probably heard about Saul's mental condition. Remember, in the previous chapter, we have the story of how Saul had hired David to play a harp in front of him to keep his demons asleep, to keep him from going nuts, to make him harmonious. And so John Gill speculates that that occurred before this Goliath incident, and so the Philistines said, well, the Philistines have got a mentally ill king. It's a good time to attack. But all that speculation. Now, here's some geography. They were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah. Let's take a look at the map here. If you will look at Bethlehem and go about 20 miles to the west in a straight line, you end up at Gath. That's where Goliath is from. Now, that's at the very head of, the very bottom, I guess, of the Valley of Elah, which is a small valley there. And if you go along that valley, you get to a place called Azekah. Then if you go along the road from Azekah, heading east, actually it's about southeast now, you hit Succoth. Another 4 or 5 miles, you hit to Adullam, where David spent some time in a cave there, you recall. So basically, somewhere, let's say if you're at Azekah and Succoth, and if you look at Bethlehem as an anchor point, that's about maybe 12 or 13 miles west of Bethlehem, due west. Right there at the foothills, as the mountains of Ephraim slope on down to the plains of the Shephelah, the flat area that stays flat all the way to the Mediterranean coast. So that's where we are. Azekah, one of the towns that's mentioned, means dug over, a town in the Shephelah or the low hills of Judah, according to Easton's. This was also the place where the five confederated Amoritish kings were defeated by Joshua and the army destroyed by a hailstorm. That would be in Joshua's southern campaign. Ephes-Damin in the area there means a boundary of blood. It was probably so called as having been the scene of frequent sanguinary conflicts between Israel and the Philistines, because Israel's always fighting the Philistines right in this area. It has been identified with a modern place called Beit Fazed, which means house of bleeding. Now, Elah, the valley there, means a valley of oaks, or a valley of terebinths, which was a tree back then. It was near Succoth and Azekah, of course. That's where we are now. There's a modern wadi there, a valley where a dry riverbed, which is a valley, and it's called the Valley of the Acacia. And acacia, of course, is another famous wood that's in the land of Israel. This is from Easton's 1800s. The terebinths from which the Valley of Elah take its name still cling to their ancient soil on the west side of the valley near Succoth. There's a very large and ancient tree of this kind known as the Terebinth of Wadi Sur, 55 feet in height, its trunk 17 feet in circumference, and the breadth of its shade no less than 75 feet. In other words, an oak tree on steroids. It marks the upper end of the Elah Valley and forms a noted object, being one of the largest terebinths in Palestine. Well, that's sort of interesting. Socal is the place where the Philistines encamped when they invaded Judah after their defeat at Michmash. That's what we're looking at now, the story of David and Goliath. It lay on the northern side of the Valley of Elah. Socal was a city that belonged to Judah. We read that in Joshua 15:35, Jarmuth and Adullam, Socal and Azekah. We've just mentioned Azekah and Adullam. They're right there in the area, right? 10, 12, 15, 20 miles west of Bethlehem. And, of course, Bethlehem is about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So, all of this shows that the Philistines still had a great presence in Israel, despite their previous defeat at Michmash, unless they had just recently marched into Socal. But if they'd been living there for a while, it shows that the Israelites were plagued with these Philistines all during the monarchy of Saul. Now, I have an artist's sketch in black and white taken by a traveler in the 19th century of the Valley of Elah. And you see a long, flat plain there in the middle of two mountain ridges, sort of a typical-looking valley. We need to remember that this is what we're going to look at. We're going to see the Philistines on one of those hills and the Israelites on another of those hills, both of them looking down in a valley where they can hear each other talk and where they can watch Goliath go down into the plain in the middle and yell, and everybody could hear him as he taunted them for 40 days, as we'll see in a minute. Now notice in verse 2, Saul is with the army here. So Saul, if he had gone crazy, he was in one of his lucid spells. He had been cured by the harp of David before this. Again, it all depends on the timing, and the timing is nobody knows the timing. But we're going to see that David is going to kill Goliath while Saul is holed up with his army scared to attack. Now that's going to have future implications, of course, as Saul gets jealous of David in our later accounts. Now we have a little reconciliation problem here in verse 2. The text says that the men of Israel were camped in the valley of Elah. And then in verse 3 it says that Israel stood on the mountain on the other side. One place says valley, one place says mountain. Well, here's a way to reconcile that. Israel first camped in the valley as they marched into that valley. And then the first contingent of the army then ascended into the mountain opposing the Philistines. So I'm assuming that they came into the valley and then continued on up into the mountains where it was safer. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 4 through 7. Then a champion named Goliath from Gath came out from the Philistine camp. He was 9 feet 9 inches tall and wore a bronze helmet and bronze scale armor that weighed 125 pounds. There was bronze armor on his shins, those are called greaves, and a bronze sword was slung between his shoulders. His spear shaft was like a weaver's beam, and the iron point of his spear weighed 15 pounds. In addition, a shield bearer was walking in front of him. Now, all the details are given for artistic effect to make it apparent why people were scared of this guy. He was called a champion in verse 4. This was an old idea. It happened all through the Middle Ages. One king would say to the other king, why don't we just get out here and fight it out mano a mano to save all our troops getting killed? But they never did it. They was always talking about it, but they never did it. But this time they did do it. The idea was to save a battle and just have a two-person duel. But this was to the advantage of the Philistines because they have a 9-foot giant for their champion. And how many times you've seen a 9-foot champion? I mean, even in the NBA, you don't have 9-foot people. John Gill says all of the armor together weighed about 272 pounds. That's a lot of armor to be carrying around. There's no way that anybody was going to beat Goliath. Now, he was from Gath. Gath was one of the places where the Anakim, who were giants, were driven out in the times of Joshua, and Goliath descended from those giants. We read in Joshua 11:22, there were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza and Gath and in Ashdod some remained. And Goliath was a descendant of those, or he was from the Anakim family, most probably. Now let's look at a little bit of geography about Goliath's hometown. Gath itself means a wine vat. It's one of the 5 royal cities of the Philistines, of course. That would be Gaza, Ashdod, Ashtaroth, Gath, and Ekron. Now later on in the history of Israel, David fled from Saul to Achish, who was king of Gath. We'll see that in 1 Samuel 21 when we get there. Afterwards, Gath was conquered by David in 2 Samuel 8. It occupied a strong position on the borders of Judah and Philistia, that same area here where we are. Gath is actually written about on monuments on the ancient Near Eastern monuments about B.C. 1500, which is a little bit earlier than where we are now in the 1000s. This is an historical event, I guess, is what I'm trying to emphasize. This is not just a Sunday school story. Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible says he was 9 feet 9 inches tall. The ESB has Goliath's height at 6 cubits and a span. Now, a cubit was from the elbow to the top of the middle finger. A span was from the top of the middle finger to the end of the thumb. And, of course, that's not standard because some people have longer spans and longer cubits. And that might explain why some of the other translations don't have him quite precisely at 9 feet 9 inches as the New Holman Christian Study Bible does. For example, the NASB, as I said, has 6 cubits and a span. The NIV and the New Living Bible have Goliath as being over 9 feet tall. The Septuagint has Goliath about 8 feet tall. The Amplified and the Message have he's almost 10 feet high. The New Century Bible has 9 feet and 4 inches. So we don't want to be too precise there. Let's just say he was one tall dude. He had a bronze helmet. Helmets back then were made of animal skins covered with bronze. His bronze scale armor, if you'll think of the mail on a medieval knight's uniform, that chain mail, I think that's what's being talked about here, at least in this translation. It weighed 125 pounds. That's a lot of armor. NASB has 5,000 shekels. NIV note agrees here with the Holman Christian Study Bible. That note says that the armor weighed about 125 pounds, about 57 kilograms. Now, Goliath is said in verse 6 to be carrying a sword. Other translations have him carrying a javelin. That's the NASB. KJV has a target of brass. So apparently that word's a little fuzzy too. But whatever it was, a javelin or a sword, I'm sure it excited terror in the hearts of onlookers. The tip of his spear was 15 pounds. And that's heavy. You throw a spear with a 15-pound tip. The NIV note agrees with the Holman Christian Study Bible. It was 15 pounds. The NASB has 600 shekels. More literal. Now, Goliath had a shield carry with him in verse 7. One wonders why a man as strong as Goliath needed a shield carrier. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about that. Quote, in consequence of their, referring to the soldiers' items of defensive equipment, in consequence of their great size and weight, the Oriental warrior had a trusty and skillful friend whose office it was to bear the large shield which he avoided the missile weapons of the enemy, or by which he avoided the missile weapons of the enemy. So if Goliath wasn't bad enough, he had somebody out there to help him to ward off oncoming missiles or oncoming sword attacks or whatever. We go now to 1 Samuel 17, verses 8 through 10. He, that's Goliath, stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Again the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And what Goliath is saying, why do you come out? What's the point of drawing your troops up like you're going to attack me? You know you're not going to attack. There's no need to line up for a battle. We could attack you too. We could have a big battle. A lot of people get killed, but we could just decide this thing mano a mano. And of course, the answer to the why question is because they were scared of him. That's why they didn't come out to fight with him. Goliath says, am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? He's trying to make a contrast between the Philistine and you pitiful servants or slaves of Saul. He could have been saying, as John Gill says, look, you might as well be servants of me as servants of Saul. You might as well be my slave. Either way, you're still a slave, because Saul is no good. Or he could be mocking the lowly status of the Israelite army. He's calling them slaves, as according to him, the Philistine. I'm a proud Philistine. I'm a free man, and you guys are slaves. Now, when he keeps calling himself the Philistine, it has been speculated that he's talking about himself as the Philistine who had been given high rank in command. But people dispute whether Goliath ever got high rank in command. He might have been real strong with his muscles, but he might not have been so smart with his brain. He might have just been put out there as a champion. We don't know. Now this taunt, you send a man out here, we fight, and if I lose, Goliath says, I'll be your servant. the Philistines will be your servants. Well, he did lose. As we know from the story, David ended up killing him. But the Philistines never became servants of the Israelites. So this was an empty vote, a boast, apparently. Now, how can we explain that? Perhaps Goliath had no authority to subject Philistia to the terms of the duel. I don't believe that. He's out there shouting it for 40 days. In law, that would be called apparent authority. Even if he didn't actually have actual authority, he had apparent authority, and he binds his principal. And his principal is the Philistine army. So that doesn't do it with me. I think that most likely what happened is the Philistines welched on the deal. Now, that assumes there was a deal that the Israelite, that David had accepted the challenge when he went out there to kill him. Gil says, nah, there was no deal. I don't know how he knows that. It doesn't say either way. But at any rate, David got the satisfaction of killing the champion, but the Philistines did not become the slaves of the Israelites. They still bedeviled Israel for the rest of Saul's life. In verse 10, Goliath says, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Now, what he's basically saying is, you guys are cowards. Come on out here and fight. We go now to 1 Samuel 17, verses 11 through 15. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah. That would be Jesse. Whose name was Jesse, and he had eight sons. Jesse had eight sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The three older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the three oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. Now notice that it wasn't only Israel that was greatly afraid and dismayed in verse 11. It was Saul also. When Saul and all Israel, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Notice the change in Saul. He was very brave in three previous situations. For example, in fighting the Ammonites at the very first of his reign, we read in 1 Samuel 11:6, when Saul heard these words concerning the Ammonites, the Spirit of God suddenly took control of him, and his anger burned furiously. And dealing with the Philistines at Michmash in 1 Samuel 14:36, first part of the verse, Saul said, let's go down after the Philistines tonight and plunder them until the morning. Don't let even one remain. And then when he was dealing with the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15:6, we read this. He warned the Kenites, those were a tribe friendly to Israel, since you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, go on and leave. Get away from the Amalekites or I'll sweep you away with them. So he's planning on conquering the Amalekites, doesn't want to confuse the Amalekites with the friendly Kenites. But now, facing the Philistines, the Spirit of God had left him now, and now he's timorous and fearful. He was afraid even though his first cousin Abner, the great military general, was present. We'll read about Abner later on in the stories of David. Abner was a great and valiant general. That didn't matter. Abner didn't help fight Goliath and the Philistines. Saul was afraid even though his great son Jonathan was there. Remember, Jonathan had routed the whole army of the Philistines at Michmash just carrying one person with him, climbing up that crag and inducing panic into the camp of the Philistines, and they all fled. So there was Abner, there was Jonathan, there was the formerly great Saul. There was warriors everywhere, and they were scared to death. Why were they afraid? Well, here's a possible answer. Leadership means everything, especially in times of war. Saul's screwed-up spirit was destroying the people he was leading. Now let's look at the chronological problem here. Again, as I said, nobody knows the chronology here. But mixed in with the chronological problem is a textual problem here, according to Adam Clark, and it's too complicated to go into, unless you want to be a PhD in textual criticism, which I don't. But he suggests that, well, he tells us that in the Septuagint, verse 12 to 31 is missing. And also the 41st verse and the 54th verse all the way to the end of the chapter is missing. And also the 1 Samuel, in 1 Samuel 18, the 9th, 10th, 11th, 17th, 18th, and 19th verse are missing. But all of those verses are found in the Codex Alexandrinus, but hey, you see my point, on and on and on. And so Clark says that with those verses in the text, it's impossible to make a clear, consistent sense of the history. I don't know why. I'm getting ready to do it. I don't see anything that's inconsistent. But anyway, he says if those verses are taken in as genuine, the ingenuity of man has hitherto failed to free the whole from apparent contradiction and absurdity. I must confess that where everyone else has failed, I have no hope of succeeding. I must, therefore, leave all farther attempts to justify the chronology and refer to those who have written for and against the genuineness of this part of the common Hebrew text. Well, that's a serious textual problem there, and it's way over my head. I'm going to assume that all the verses were there in the original text there in all the translations, as far as I can tell. And I don't see why the story is inherently, at least not yet, why there's problems with harmonizing events in the story. But I mentioned that to you just in case you might be interested in becoming a PhD in textual criticism. Now, verse 12 tells us that Jesse was old in the days of Saul. That would explain why Jesse's not out there fighting. And the three older sons of Jesse, we've already met these gentlemen before when Samuel was overlooking them in order to choose David. They were there with Saul, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. Now, verse 12 says that Jesse had 8 sons. So here in 1 Samuel, Jesse has 8. 1 Chronicles only has 7. Some options as to why that 8th son is not mentioned. The 8th might have been a grandson. He might have been a son by another woman, a second wife, or a concubine. He might have been an 8th who had died without children and therefore disappeared, and so Chronicles doesn't mention him. The first three are mentioned here, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. 1 Chronicles goes on to mention Nethanel the 4th, Radai the 5th, and Ozem the 6th. The 7th is missing, and then David is called the 7th in 1 Chronicles 2, verses 13 through 15. Now David would go back and forth from the encampment there in the valley of Elah, and then he'd go back, and it says back and forth. We don't know whether that means between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, or between Succah and Bethlehem. The camp is at Succah in the valley of Elah. I suspect it's the latter. Either way, it doesn't matter, because if David used to run errands between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, working for Saul and then going back to see his father at Bethlehem, that would be a normal thing for him to do. And if he had been doing that, then by going to Succah and back to Bethlehem, that would seem natural too, because Saul has now moved from Jerusalem to Succah. So David is basically going from Saul back to his father Jesse back and forth. Nobody would have thought that was strange. Verse 15, in fact, it says David went back and forth from Saul. It doesn't say a particular town, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock. So he was working for Saul part-time, and then he was working for his dad, Jesse, part-time as a shepherd. David was content to be a shepherd, even though he knew he had been anointed to be a king. He's a good example of someone who is content where he is while not doing something big. Whew, what a lesson, because most of us spend most of our life not doing anything big. Note that Jesse did not try to promote his son as king here at this battle at Succah. If he had been trying to promote his son as king, Jesse would have sent David in to fight in the army. That would have been a logical thing to do. That's a much better path for advancement than tending sheep and playing the harp for Saul part-time. There would be the possibility, if David was in the army, that Saul would get killed and David might be proclaimed a hero and proclaimed a king. But no, Jesse didn't do that. He let God providentially figure out how to accomplish his purposes. It is impossible to figure out how God's going to do anything, because what he does is always so incredibly unusual and off the wall and unforeseen, it's impossible to plan the future. It's impossible. You cannot control the future. We go now to 1 Samuel 17, verses 16 through 19. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines." Now, as I read this, verse 16, I noticed that Goliath was taunting the Israelites for 40 days, and I thought, 40, that number shows up an awful lot. So I went back and looked at the commentators, and I found one commentator that made a note of this, and he quoted Augustine. Augustine saw, that was Ellicott, the commentator, quoted Augustine. Augustine saw a typological connection with Jesus. King David was the type of King Jesus, as is well known. David suffered 40 days of temptation, as Jesus also suffered 40 days of temptation in the wilderness. Kind of an interesting connection. None of my other commentators noticed it, though, so I don't know whether Augustine is right about that or not. Verse 17, Jesse said to David, his son, even though there were at least three sons older than David still at home, depending on whether there were seven or eight children of sons of Jesse still alive at this point. I've already talked about that. If there were eight children alive, three of them are at the front. David is one, is four. That means there were four other sons that Jesse could have said, how about take some food to your three older brothers at the front? Jesse overlooked those older brothers, and he asked David to do it. Why? Well, perhaps it's because Jesse knew David's capabilities. After all, he was anointed to be a king, and plus, you know, you're going to know the character of your son. That's one reason. But another reason might have been that Jesse figured David would be safe from combat because the Philistines and the Israelites were just looking at him as a boy, not a soldier. Again, he's probably in his early 20s, but that's old enough to be a soldier. I don't know if that's a good reason or not. I think the real reason is because he knew David was going to get the job done. He was going to get the food to his brothers, whom Jesse was worried about, because he's a capable sort of guy. Now, he was to carry an ephah of roasted grain to the brothers. Now, I'm going to read you a description of this grain. It'll make you hungry. This is from John Gill. Quote, "This was wheat or barley dried in a furnace or oven and ground into meal, and being mixed with water or milk or butter or honey or oil, was eaten and reckoned very delicious." Well, if it's butter or honey or oil, it would be delicious. "And besides this, there was another sort of kali," the word here used, "which was parched pulse, as beans, peas, parched, and which to this day by the Arabs is called by this name, kali." Well, that doesn't sound so good, but basically that's pretty good food for a soldier. Now, this ephah is a half bushel, as the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it. The NIV note says that's about 15 pounds. Now, David's going to be running, John Gill says, about 4 miles from Bethlehem to Succoth. That is not accurate. John Gill has some funky distance measurements in his commentary. From Bethlehem to Succoth is about 10 miles, according, almost due west, maybe, you know, west, a little bit southwest from Bethlehem to Succoth. It's about, according to the map here, about 12, 13 miles. That's a good ways to run. 15 pounds is not, I guess, all that. That's doable with one person. One commentator said it was too much, so he had to have somebody to help him go. As a matter of curiosity, I looked up a picture of a half-bushel basket. And I looked at the basket, and I said, that is a lot to be carrying, 15 pounds of grain. But whichever commentator I got this from, and unfortunately I didn't write it down, he said that it was too much food for one person to carry, so there had to be a servant to help him carry. Well, it doesn't make any difference. He carried the food, and you notice he ran. Well, Jesse told him to run. Jesse is very anxious to relieve his sons. And he says, I want you to take 10 cuts of cheese and give to the commander of David's thousand. The thousand there is translated as unit in the NIV, David's unit. He wanted his unit commander to do right by his sons. Here's 10 cuts of cheese. Jesse wanted the commander to command his sons well in battle. Now, notice how close to a bribe this is in Western culture. This would not be tolerated in the West because it would obviously be a bribe. I remember living in China for so long. I heard the word guanxi so much, and I was having a real hard time distinguishing guanxi from a bribe when you give guanxi to a government official. I mean, it sounded exactly like a bribe to me, and I was writing a book about my time in China, and I was doing some research on that, and I found a lot of scholarly articles trying to give the reader the metaphysical difference and distinction between a bribe and guanxi, and by golly, I couldn't figure it out. I don't think I ever understood it, but that was considered okay back then. So Jesse gives the cheese to the commander. And verse 18, Jesse asked for David to bring back news, according to the NASB, news of the sons. How are they doing? Now, this is interesting. As we look at that word news, other translations don't have it as news. The American Standard Version, the Young's Literal Translation, and the King James has pledge. Bring me back a pledge. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says that tokens of a soldier's health and safety were sent home in the convenient form of a lock of their hair or piece of their nail or such like. Well, I don't know what the point of that is. I mean, you would think that, I don't know, maybe it was superstition. It just seems to me to be just as easy to say, hey, I'm all right. Why do you need a pledge? But anyway, the KJV has pledge. Bible in Basic English has bring me back a sign from the brothers. The God's Word translation has news, as does the NASB, bring back news of the brothers. The New American Bible has bring back a token of the brothers. The Holman Christian Study Bible says bring back confirmation that they're all right. Very, very minor detail, but I thought it was interesting. Now, Jesse in verse 19 tells David, your brothers are all fighting with the Philistines. Your brothers and all the men of Israel are fighting with the Philistines. Well, they weren't doing much fighting. They were basically just drawn up in battle array, looked at Goliath, and sat. In other words, that's an exaggerated statement. That's being very charitable to say that they're fighting with the Philistines. More precisely, they were drawn up prepared to fight, but they never did fight. We go to 1 Samuel 17, verses 20 through 21. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with the keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. So David leaves his flock with somebody else. He's called a keeper here. This is the only example in the Bible of a hired hand. All the other shepherds were either the sheep's owner or a member of his family, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. I guess that's to emphasize the closeness of a shepherd and the sheep, which fits the imagery of Jesus being the shepherd of his sheep in the New Testament. So David arrives at the circle of the camp. Now, what does that circle mean? Jameson Foster Brown says, quote, some feeble attempt at a rampart. It appears to have been formed by a line of carts or chariots, which from the earliest times was the practice of nomad people. Ellicott and Benson agree with that. Cambridge says that there's three possible meanings of the word circle there. They translate it as the trench, and he came to the trench of the camp. The word may mean either A, the circular rampart around the camp, that's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said, or B, a barrier formed by the baggage wagons around the camp, or C, a place where the baggage wagons of the army were kept. Well, basically that just means the baggage wagons. Carts, chariots, lined up, and they're hiding behind them. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as perimeter, and they came to the perimeter of the camp. The army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Here's my question. Why were the Israelites arrayed for battle? Goliath had been coming out and mocking them day after day. They were afraid to fight before. What made them want to fight on this day? Besides, we're going to see in just a minute, they didn't fight. They were struck with terror. Well, I guess the answer to that is they had to array for battle array. They couldn't just lollygag around in their tents because then the Philistines might have attacked them and they wouldn't be ready. So they had to get ready every day. So they were in defensive array at least. Now, the war cry. Let's read what Gill says about that. Quote, usually done when about to make the onset, when you're about to fight, to animate the soldiers and strike the greater terror into the enemy. And this noise was sometimes made with a voice in a hideous and howling way, and was called berytus by the Romans. With the Trojans, it was like the noise of cranes in the air. And it was also attended with the clashing of shields and spears. With the Persians, it was a rough, boisterous, and confused noise. So they give a war cry, line up in front of their rampart or behind their rampart, their circle of wagons, and sit there, scared to death because of Goliath. We go to 1 Samuel 17, verses 22 through 25. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words. And David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. The men of Israel said, have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Now, why did David leave his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper? That would include the food. He couldn't deliver the food right now because they were all prepared for battle. They weren't in camp. They were lined up ready to fight or defend. It does show David's courage, though, to go to the battle line. He could have stayed in the baggage train until an impending battle might have been over with, but he didn't. He went to the battle line. And then he heard the same words that Goliath had been saying for 40 days. Let's review those words again. The NIV says the same words. They translate that as Goliath's usual defiance, the same things he had spoken 40 times before, 40 days before. 1 Samuel 17, verses 8 through 10. He, Goliath, stood and shouted to the Israelite battle formations. Why do you come out to line up in battle formation? He asked them, "Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose one of your men and have him come down against me. If he wins in a fight against me and kills me, we will be your servants. But if I win against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel today. Send me a man so we can fight each other." Verse 24, we read this, "When all the men of Israel saw the men, they fled from him and were greatly afraid." Now, what does that mean? They fled, got behind their baggage wagons, maybe. It wasn't a rout. They didn't leave the field of battle. They didn't leave the field, but they probably just ran. Maybe they tentatively poked their noses out from behind the rampart and then the circle of baggage wagons. And then when they realized that he was out there shouting the same thing, they said, "Well, it's not time to fight today." And so they hopped back behind the rampart. Jai Gill says, in looking at the question, is why the Israelites even drew up for battle. I've already mentioned that, because they had to do that, because if they didn't, the Philistine army might decide to charge and they wouldn't be ready. So they at least needed to draw up for defensive purposes. John Gill says this, quote, "Even as it should seem, before they heard him, knowing who he was and what he was about to say, having seen and heard him 40 days running." In other words, they've heard this for 40 days. What are they running for? Well, as I say, my speculation is they might have tentatively advanced beyond their baggage train rampart there to see if they would have a chance to attack. But, oh no, there's Goliath again, same way he's been for the last 40 days. And so then they run back behind the ramparts again. Now, verse 24 says that the army was greatly afraid of Goliath. How could a whole army be afraid of one man? Well, John Gill says, perhaps they felt the truth that they had been totally abandoned by God made them afraid of one man. That's option number one. Here's what Matthew Henry says, quote, "How timorous and faint-hearted the men of Israel were, though they had for 40 days together been used to his haughty looks and threatening language, and having seen no execution done by either, might have learned to despise both. Yet upon his approach they fled from him and were greatly afraid." One Philistine could never thus have chased 1,000 Israelites and put 10,000 to flight unless their rock, being treacherously forsaken by them, had justly sold them and shut them up, to their rock being God. Well, that's the first option. They felt abandoned by God. Second option as to why one man could scare the whole army was the Israelite army could not bear to hear Goliath's blasphemy, according to John Gill. And I don't believe that anymore, and I believe that the federal government's going to balance its budget next year. It's not going to happen. This option says that the Israelites weren't so much afraid of personal danger, it's just that they were afraid of that blasphemy. I don't believe that's a legitimate option. Option number three, and this is my idea, I speculate that the Israelites were afraid of how Goliath could inspire the whole Philistine army against them. If the Israelites sent one Israelite out to fight Goliath, that would be bad news because the Israelite would get beat. But if they sent the whole army out against Goliath and Goliath started hewing down the front lines, then the rest of the Philistines would come back Goliath up, and that's why they were afraid. Now, verse 25 says, as it relates how the soldiers are telling David what's going on, they relate to David that King Saul would enrich the man who kills Samson with great riches, and Saul would make this killer of Goliath's house free in Israel. What does that mean? No taxes. NIV has, quote, exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Also, he'd get a daughter, too. Well, that David did end up with a couple of daughters of Saul, the second one being Michal, who didn't respect him very much, as you recall, as he came dancing with joy back into Jerusalem when they brought the ark in, and she says, "Whoa, what are you doing there, David, dancing around, making a fool out of yourself?" So maybe that was his reward for killing Goliath. Well, anyway, that was not the first daughter. But anyway, we have the stage set. We go to 1 Samuel 17, verses 26 through 27. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in accord with his word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." In other words, what we just talked about. No taxes, one daughter for a wife. The verses seem to be a little bit out of time order, which, of course, happens all the time in the scriptures. Maybe that's what Adam Clark was talking about. This doesn't make any sense. I don't know. That doesn't bother me any. Now, David, in asking about the reward, he's not asking because he wants to know how much he's going to get. He's asking for the sake of what's going to bring about the reward, the shutting up of Goliath, because he cares about Israel, not his personal glory or gain. He calls this cowardly Israelite army the armies of the living God. Those armies were still on the side of right, even though their leader Saul had degenerated. Notice how confident David is. He calls the Philistine, this uncircumcised, that means pagan, because none of the tribes in Canaan circumcised their people, their men. Nations outside of Israel did, by the way, almost all of them did. If I remember reading, I think it was old Robertson Palmer made that point. I just read that. I thought it was interesting, but in Canaan they didn't. And so it was a big distinction between the Canaanites and the Israelites. But basically he's saying this pagan, ungodly Philistine, who's going to stand up for the armies of the living God, Elohim? Notice how confident this young boy or this young man David is. So they answered and told him. They told him what they had before been discussing amongst themselves. David hadn't heard that. And that explains why he asked what the reward would be. That actually makes more sense to explain why David asked about something that was already talked about in the previous verses, is because David hadn't actually heard it yet. He walked up and then heard them talking and then asked exactly what was going on. We go now to 1 Samuel 17, verses 28 through 30, and we'll finish this audio. Now Eliab, that's David's oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down?" That means, why have you come from Bethlehem to Socah? "And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" Well, it was a keeper. He hired somebody. "I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" In other words, what's the reward going to be? It was just a question. Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. So David doesn't pay too much attention to Eliab, and he just kept on asking, what's the reward? Well, let's look at Eliab's anger toward his younger brother David. Here are some possible reasons why he might have been so angry. It could be that David's reproach was tacitly a slap at Eliab's lack of courage. After all, Eliab could have gone out and faced Goliath, but he didn't. And so David's asking him about a reward is implicitly pointing out that his older brother hadn't tried to get the reward, and Eliab might have been jealous or upset about that. Or it could be that Eliab was angry that David had come down to the battle because he was afraid that David was going to get killed in the battle, and oh, what's Jesse going to say about that? Or maybe Eliab knew David's prowess, and he thought, maybe David might go up and kill Goliath, not get killed by Goliath, but actually kill Goliath, and thus get more glory than Eliab. It's hard to know what Eliab's real motives are. They could have been good, they could have been bad, but getting angry at David? David had risked his life to bring Eliab food, and now he's yelling at him. Objectively speaking, in my humble opinion, Eliab was foolish to be angry. He knew that David had been anointed as king by Samuel. Maybe he thought that Samuel had made a mistake. I mean, I guess it would be natural to suppose that one's kid brother is not going to be a king. Maybe he was just under stress and had a bad moment, but at any rate, he had no business getting angry at David. But notice David didn't let it bother him. He just said, okay, he turned away from Eliab and went to other people and say, hey, what's going on here? What's the reward the king's offering? And David said to Eliab in verse 29, hey, it's just a question, isn't it? Get over it. The NIV translates that, can't I even speak, Eliab? Can't I even speak? David, though younger than Eliab, was not intimidated at all by the accusations against him. Well, Eliab said in verse 28, you have come down in order to see the battle. Well, that's judging David's motives without proof, without evidence. And what he's saying is, you came down to see the battle. And what he means is, well, there's some options is what he means. It could mean that David is just struck with idle curiosity, kind of like the folks who went out to see the first battle of Manassas in the American War between the states. Oh, let's get our picnic baskets out there and let's go see our Yankees beat the crap out of those rebels. Of course, the reverse happened. Praise the Lord. But anyway, that's what Eliab is saying to David. You're just wasting everybody's time down here because you want to watch a big battle. Or Eliab could have thought that you're coming down here to see the battle because you're trying to make yourself famous. Eliab might have been thinking of Samuel's anointing of David, thinking, David's coming down here. Saul looks like he's in a bad way. Saul might make a fatal charge one day, get killed, and David's going to end up being king. And so Eliab is saying, that's the only reason you came down here, for your own personal glory. Well, whatever it was, Eliab doesn't show himself to be a very good character here. And David shows himself to be very brave, and that bravery is carry over into the last chapter of chapter 17, which we'll take up in our next audio, and we will see David slaying the giant. We'll see you in that next audio. I hope so, and I hope you enjoyed this one.